listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 16th installment in our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history and political economy of the USSR. And we go now to discuss the Spanish Civil War as a model of what to do and not to do, right?
Yep. So today we're going to talk about the Spanish Civil War. And in a way, it's going to link us back to the Soviet Union, the main topic of our discussion. The Spanish Civil War is the third example of fascism between the wars in Europe. We've done Italy, we've done Austria, and now we are in Spain. And before I start, I wanted to read a message I got from a Spanish internet friend. It's in Spanish, so I'll be translating. But it relates to something you said in a program some time ago when you sort of expostulated about that, for example, the Franco-fascism lasted until well after World War II. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so interestingly, this little message actually relates to that and also illuminates something I didn't know. So this Spanish person writes, my uncle, who was a great hero, anti-fascist, suffered a great deal, a heroic figure, this uncle, he says, the nephew, my uncle always considered the Americans and the English as traitors for failing to comply with the Yalta Accords. Mm. In those accords, it was decided to eliminate all of the fascist regimes in Europe, and especially that of Franco. And that would have been Stalin's emphasis, you know, mm-hmm. or maybe even FDR, something to look into.
Right.
He says, but with the Cold War, this elimination of the fascist regimes was no longer a priority.
Mm.
So apparently they had agreed at the Yalta with FDR and that idiot Churchill.
And Truman.
That these would go out, but they didn't. And we know why, because they were anti-communist.
Well, yeah.
All right, so I have to go into a little bit, but very briefly, of the history from 1931 to the actual civil war in Spain, the events. So, and what I was going to say. Actually, what we're seeing all the time is the weakness of democracies in a... you know, in a bourgeois democracy being very weak before the brunt of fascism. So what we have in Spain in 1931 is the declaration of the Second Republic, of the Second Spanish Republic, and that's second because there was something in 1873, 1874, 1 year, and the Republic would be a rejection of the monarchy. So we have the Second Republic in Spain from 1931 to 1939, the end of the Civil War. And that republic was parliamentary bourgeois democracy with presence in the parliament of left parties. And we have three phases in this Second Republic from 1931 to 1939. We have the first 2 years, 31 to 33, which is called the biennium, the Republican Socialist Biennium, with very moderate reforms of land, education, some attempts to moderate the influence of the church in schools, etc. You know, sort of very mild. But in 1933 and through 1935, we have the Black Biennium, that is the reaction of the, let's call them conservative parties, which I always call reactionary. with these reforms upset the reactionaries, and so we have the intrusion into the government of the Catholic Right. Which actually formed a confederation. It was called the Confederación Española de Derechas Autónomas. That would be Spanish Confederation of Autonomous Rights. The SEDA, I'm going to refer to as the SEDA.
And, you know, this
and
is,
they intended to rectify the reforms.
Yeah, this is interesting, too. I mean, we think about, we've discussed the Austro-fascism, the period prior to the Pan-Germanic trend. In other words, the native Catholic Austrian fascism. And, of course, Italy, the home of the Vatican, and, the center of Catholicism. Now you have
a
little
group. That's right. In 1928, Mussolini formed a concordat with the church.
Right.
With the Vatican, giving it state status,
right.
Recognizing it as a state, and giving enormous benefits to it.
Right.
The Vatican claimed, did I say this last time, in order to support Mussolini's fascism, which was important because that way Mussolini could control the religious masses,
Right.
He needed them. And so the church would deliver them if the Italian state would compensate the Vatican for the loss of all of central Italy. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think about the global picture as well. I'm thinking of my grandparents, for example, on both of my paternal grandparents and my maternal grandfather, Roman Catholics, Italians here in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That would influence, that's right.
For sure.
Long arm of the Vatican, indeed.
Yeah.
And so this Seda, this Catholic rite, which was called the Black Biennium by the left. And so between 1933 and 1935, the intention to rectify the reforms, which were secular reforms, you see, that's what was threatening the church. So what they wanted was an affirmation. They were for an affirmation and defense of the principles of the Christian civilization. And they wanted a revision of the Constitution, of the Republican Constitution, in this key. So the Seda saw itself as a defensive organization formed to protect religion, family, and property. A church. During these 2 years, something tremendous happened, and that was the insurrection, the anarchist but also socialist insurrection in Asturias, which was a mining country, of 1934, which was considerable and was an authentic social revolution with taking over of factories and sort of attempt to form Soviets, but it was suffocated with the intervention of the army. Now, we're talking about, there is a Republican state in power, but it's got a right-wing predominance in the parliament, and so we see in this Spain, as this Republican Spain, and this, which is, you know, we see that the army is sent to suffocate a social revolution. Now, the third stage of this republic, the Second Republic in Spain, was the triumph of the coalition of the left, which we know as the Popular Front. And that happened in the elections, in the general elections of 1936. This Popular Front could actually govern in peace for only 5 months because the coup of July of 1936, promoted by a part of the army, occurred and opened the Spanish Civil War. So the actual Popular Front, had only 5 months of peace before the army rebelled and Franco came from with whatever, the Baleares, no, the Azores, the Morocco, I don't know.
Yeah.
But he was out of Spain.
Yeah.
Now this, you know, this war, I think principally was between fascism and communism, even though this was a Republican state, supposedly. So it had many fronts. It was a class war, it was a religious war, it was a war of nationalisms, of opposing nationalisms.
Yeah, the person, it was personal too. You had Sanjurjo, you had Franco and Mola. I mean, there were, you know, some generals that all thought they should be in charge, and one of them dies in a plane crash in the middle of this invasion in July.
Yeah, and I think it must be noted, you know, where I'm going, where I want to go, is to compare apples and pears, to compare what happens to a state that's attacked by fascism that doesn't have a solid center, like the Soviet Union did.
Right.
And a state that is so weak, I would say. You know, I want to, we'll see, I'll proceed. I'll just, you know, summarize what the Republican side was made up of. So the Republican side was the elected government, the so-called democratically elected government, and which was formed as the Popular Front, so that it had a coalition of Republican parties. And to these Republican parties, Democratic, were added the Communist Party of Spain. I guess it was the Marxist-Leninist of the Communist Party of Spain, which wasn't very large. Okay. And the PUM, what I call the PUM, the P-O-U-M, Partido Obrero Unido Marxista, I think. So, Workers' Party of United Marxists. Now, this party defined itself as a revolutionary Marxist, and it was in opposition of Stalinism. So you can see it opposed Stalinism, what they called Stalinism.
Yeah, it was formed by a fusion of the Trotskyist communist left of Spain and the workers and peasants bloc, which was right, and with the right opposition. And supposedly Trotsky opposed the affiliation with the right opposition. And George Orwell served with that party's militia.
Yes,
and it helped form his quote-unquote anti-authoritarian ideas in his later life.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's right. The PUM has supposedly broken from Marxist, from Trotsky at a certain point, but I don't have enough information about it. Do you? I don't know.
We don't have to go that deep into it. They're the Trotskyists. Okay, next.
Yeah, I mean, they were formed as Trotskyists.
Right.
Now, we have to remember that this is 1936-37, and we have to remember what's going on in Moscow, too.
And in Europe. Germany is a couple of years away from invading the Soviet Union, and Trotsky and Trotskyists everywhere are more opposed to Stalin than anybody in the world. That should tell you just about everything.
That's right. And this, you know, it was close to the left opposition of the Russian, the left opposition in Russia, meaning Trotskyism.
Right.
So we're talking about a party of the left, of the communist left, supposedly, but not Stalinist. So the PUM, as I call him, criticized the degeneration, the bureaucratic and totalitarian degeneration of the Russian Revolution. Now, we have to remember that at this point, the USSR was the only source of arms for this republic.
That's right.
France and England blockaded. They were neutral.
Right.
There was, you know, meanwhile, the Italians, fascists and the Nazis were going to launch their whole gizmo, you know, their whole...
They're on the move, yep.
Toys, over Spain. Yep. And so the PUM was anti-Stalinist.
Because what's interesting, you have, quote-unquote, a popular nationalist uprising that suddenly has an air force, for example, that was manufactured in Germany. You have a blockade, essentially, of goods by sea with German submarines. So the Spanish government is isolated. No one's taking a stand with it other than, you know, essentially communists and other workers from around the world. And you have the fascists inside Spain, openly supported by Germany and Italy, and tacitly supported by the United States and Great Britain and France by allowing the rest of this to happen under their nose.
Yeah, and this is what I was going to say, and I'm interrupting all this, but I mean, I think that the Spanish Civil War was a test for the Western democracy to see whether the Soviet Union could be beaten by Germany.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they derived the wrong conclusions, mm-hmm. that it was weak, that it could not organize, when in fact the organization that the Soviet Union provided, the advisors, the senior officials, experienced army, etc., that it provided, was continuously subverted by the PUM.
You know, not for nothing, and just very mischievously, and I'll just make the statement and drop it. I wonder what lesson they're drawing from getting their behinds beat in Syria right now by Russia.
That's right.
So let's go on.
That's right. So we have this Stalin party and allied to the Republic, and so far it will be thrown out of the game,
right,
after Barcelona, and we'll concentrate on Barcelona eventually. We'll go to Barcelona because that's where actually the Stalinist, Trotskyist ideologies will work out.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Out. Yep. And perhaps we're seeing them work out there today. But go ahead.
And so the PUM was the only party that condemned the trials of Moscow in their periodical La Battaglia, the battle.
The battle was with the Soviet government. Okay,
yeah.
That should tell you something also.
It was a proxy war between the Trotskyists and, you know, Spain. And this is never much emphasized,
right,
because we have, I think, Orwell's version, very romanticized version of homage to Catalonia. But Catalonia was not as revolutionary or as red as Asturias, and it wasn't even as red as Madrid.
That's correct.
You know, so the accusation that Madrid is Francoist and Catalonia is all, this is all bullshit.
Yeah, and so, you know, we're covering a lot, and so we've got about 8 minutes left to, I think we'll cover what we can, and then we'll pick it up next week instead of rushing, because this is, in my opinion, what happened in Spain, and I believe this is your opinion also from you know, the notes back and forth earlier, from what you've been posting at Facebook. And by the way, I encourage people to go to your Facebook page, Luciana Bohne, it's LuciannaBohne at Facebook, because of some of the stuff you post. You do so much reading and parsing and all of that. But what happened in Spain, the Spanish Civil War, in my opinion, is extremely relevant to the politics of what's happening right now in the United States. And so I think, and rather than what people tend to do on the left and say, okay, well, that's what they did, so this is exactly what we have to do. No. There's a methodology that was applied to the understanding of things at that time, and a methodology that needs to be developed to do it here.
Yes.
But go ahead. So we'll take our time and go through it. And if it runs into next week, c'est la vie. So we've got now 7.5 minutes.
all right. So the PUM, the PUM actually complicated relation, the PUM's enmity toward Moscow complicated relations of the Republic with the Soviet Union, which was providing weapons and you know, war supplies. So this was really a problem.
Yeah, I mean, what you have for people to you know, sort of just get it in a nutshell, you've got an elected government that has the support, it's a left-of-center government, it has the support of much of the left, against a fascist, literally a fascist coup being undertaken by the generals. And, you know, among the left, there are, and the only people on the outside that are willing to help the government is the USSR. And inside the assembled popular groupings supporting the government is this PUM, which openly advocates the overthrow of the Soviet government, in essence, which, of course,
that's right.
would complicate it. So what you have is a fifth column, basically, inside the support for the government that, in essence, is supporting the fascist coup by making support for the government problematic for the USSR.
That's right. And there's more. So we've got this poem that we talked about that will come back again because, the stage will be Catalonia.
Right.
And then the government, the Republican government also has the trade unions, and in the trade union in Catalonia especially are anarchist. In fact, the biggest force in the trade union called the CNT, that's the Congreso Nacional de Trabajadores or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, let's not get lost on this. So, in addition to the PUM, you have the syndicalist parties, and most of them are, the CNT is the biggest one, and it is anarchist. And then there is the UGT, which is socialist. And so these are the left parties within the Republican, the PUM, the UGT, which is trade union, the CNT, which is the anarchist trade union. And what these wanted was to, within this attack by fascism, they wanted to carry out the social revolution. Within this attack, they also want to overthrow the Republican government, which receives arms from the Soviet Union.
Right.
And establish a workers' revolution. And this is Trotsky.
Right. So here's what you have. At the moment, you start out with, say, one unit as the resistance to this coup, which is the United Front, consisting of bourgeois elements, social democrats, socialists, communists, your grandmother, whomever. And what these people want to do, in the midst of that, they want to separate from that and follow some purist line where they stand alone, and plus they have no help from the Soviet Union because that's already been promised to the government. So what they're doing is basically splitting the resistance to the fascists.
Right. And, what happens is they have to steal the arms from the Soviet Union.
Right.
Delivery to the Republicans, and the Soviet Union demands the outlaw of the PUM, which eventually happens.
Right.
It becomes, so this is how not to fight fascism, by having the revolution, the social revolution, in the middle of a fascist attack. But this is pure Trotsky.
Right.
He was cheering the fascist invasion of the Soviet Union because that would give the opportunity to overthrow Stalin and establish. Can you imagine how nutty this is?
Yep.
So, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
I
feel exactly the same way. It is insanity, facially.
Yeah.
If you look at strategy, if you were going to conquer a playground at the elementary school, you would give it more thought than this apparently is given, because the last thing that you do in the middle of a battle is split up your forces and or declare war on them, your own forces.
Yeah. So you will see, they will take over everything and they won't be able to function. Anyway, so allied to the Republicans were also the Nationalist Party of the Basque National Party, because in 1931, the Republican Parliament gave Basque country autonomy, a state of autonomy. So even the church, that was the only church in Spain that sided with the Republicans, and it was the Basque Church, and those priests were severely that you know the clerics were severely persecuted by Franco afterwards.
Yeah.
The on the let's call it the fascist side, that is the subverters, that is the National Front, was organized against the military, was organized around the military, the army,
right,
with Francisco Franco at the head as generalissimo y jefe del gobierno de Estado,
right,
as the, you know, the chief, the duce.
Right.
Now, politically, integrated into the, what you call it, the fascists, was the Falange, the monarchists, but the church, of course, and the Seda, you know, the all those who voted for the Seda.
Right. I'm going to interrupt here because we're out of time, but just on this note that there was a whole collection of various tendencies within that grouping, and for some reason, they were able to function as a unit and win while the left was busy eating each other. And we're going to pick it up next week and start analyzing that phenomenon. Thank you, Luciana, very
Excellent.
Much.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. As we mentioned at the head end of this broadcast, this was the 16th installment in the conversation that we've had with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the USSR. We felt it was particularly timely given the fact that it's been 100 years this month since what was called the Great October Revolution. And if you would like to hear some of the earlier broadcasts, you can go to our website, communitypublicradio.org, and there will be a link to archived newscasts. You click on that and go back and look. They're generally aired on Wednesdays, going back 15 weeks from this week. We will also post at some point in the near future an aggregate list of the elements of this series. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Greetings and salutations. An important milestone has passed us this week, Hawk Watchers. Can you guess what it is? I can give you a hint. It was 365 days in the making. It will be considered one of the biggest turning points and events in modern world history. If you still haven't guessed what I'm referring to, let's take a look at my final hint.
And which Republican candidate has the best chance of winning the general election?
Of the declared ones right now, Donald Trump.
America is crying tonight. I'm not sure how much of America, but a very, very significant portion, and I mean literally crying.
World's shining light of democracy has gone dark.
Feels like the end of the world.
Get your abortions now, because we're going to be and we're going to have to live with it.
You're not having a terrible, terrible dream. Also, you're not dead and you haven't gone to hell. This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Oh, my God. I'm talking about the election of one Donald J. Trump as President of the United States, Hawk Watchers. This week, on November 8th, we marked the official one-year anniversary of the night U.S. citizens chose Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton, Jill Stein, and Gary Johnson to be the quote-unquote leader of the free world. And what a jam-packed 365 days it has been. We've seen political discourse devolve into name-calling, finger-pointing, paranoid, xenophobic conspiracy-mongering, and that is just on the Democratic side of the country. We've seen the Republicans finally get the ball in their court by having not only the presidency, but the Congress and the Supreme Court in their grubby little hands and still find a way to consistently fail their base on their long-time campaign promises. It's been quite the year. But despite all the exasperation, the broken promises, the new wave McCarthyism, the embarrassing Twitter wars, the fake news, the tappers tapping, the blitzers wolfing, the military-industrial chest thumping, the Kim Jong-unings ooning, the protests, the alt-right temper tantrums, and Antifa's adolescent angst. We here in the United States are, well, we're still standing. The world hasn't ended, and thankfully, there are still those of us out there in the darkness watching the hawks.
If you want to know what's going on in your city, in your streets, never back down like Tyrell, and the truth is what you seek. To analyze, investigate from the bottom to the top. You speak your mind like Sean Stone, whether they like it or not. I got Tabitha, Miss Wallace, with the wisdom and the pearl. Between the outrage and the evidence, what's going on in this world?
Watching the hawks, watching the hawks, watching the hawks. Listen when they talk.
Welcome everyone to Watching the Hawks. I am Tyrell Ventura.
And I'm Tabitha Wallace. So, 1 year later, are we all gonna make it?
Are we gonna make it? We've made it. You know, we're okay. I don't think the sky has fallen. You know, and not yet.
Well, I think what's probably the most hilarious about that is every single person in there crying and talking about how, oh my God, it's gonna be awful for everyone, is white.
Ooh, interesting point.
A position in which, you know, oh, I have to go out and get my abortions. You're probably not the person that has to really worry about that. You're not the person who doesn't have the money or the access or is hours and hours and hours away from it in their own state. So I think it's a little bit to be like, oh my God.
It is kind of interesting.
What about all the people that things like are going to happen to? Not me, though.
One half of privileged elites complaining about another half of privileged elites. Everybody else on the bottom's like, you both have kind of screwed us over and over again.
Yeah.
Our choices were terrible this year. Or last year. But what, you know, Tab, I want to ask you though, what are your thoughts now on the 1 year anniversary of that election night? You were at the Javits Center, mm-hmm. at, you know, when Hillary failed to come out of hiding that night.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on a year as Donald Trump as president?
I mean, I'm not surprised by. I was ish surprised when he got elected, because we all kind of knew it was going to be a thin margin. I wasn't entirely surprised that he got elected, and I'm not entirely surprised that his agenda has not moved as smoothly. We talked about it beforehand, this idea of, I'm going to do infrastructure, that costs money. I'm going to do tax breaks, like we learned today, that takes money.
Yep.
And I think that is one thing where he just kind of has this idea as a businessman that you can always get cash somewhere, and that's not how the business of the country works. So, you know, it's a lot like you said, too. It's this idea of, oh, then you got everything and you still couldn't get any of your agendas through?
Yeah, still couldn't. I mean, the biggest failure was the healthcare thing, because it's like, you know, you turn to Congress and say, hey, we've been trying to repeal Obamacare for years. Biggest thing we complain about, and they didn't even have a plan in place to do it.
How many years did they need? That's my problem. So you have one side that just has a boilerplate plan that doesn't fit everybody and nobody wants to work on it, and the other side came forward with, well, we got it. We have a much better plan, but they still, even with all the power in the world, they couldn't come up with another plan.
It's amazing to me that it seems like that the longer that Donald has been president, it seems like both political sides and political discourse has pretty much just fallen to be his style of political discourse.
Yes.
I mean, the Democrats are basically just like, oh, Russia and this and oh, you know, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to get to very quickly, though, is that we asked our Facebook fans what they thought of Donald's first year in office.
And here was some of the responses were pretty great. Mahmoud Henry Rogers said, no World War III. He has defied expectations.
David Mobley said, despite all of his rhetoric, he's just another deep state puppet like all the rest.
Oh, so it's tough. Ricky Sadel actually said, outstanding job, Mr. President. Mainstream media looks like a joke. I can't even argue with any of them, because I feel like everybody on all sides is kind of right. Some people, you know, base is disappointed. Yeah. The Democrats are. Well, we'll get into that a little bit later. But people can see this. But yeah, and they still are seeing him as another deep state puppet.
Deep state puppetry.
Keeping in mind that the challenges we face over time tend to change, the Founding Fathers developed mechanisms for changing the nation's constitution. Amendments are a two-step process, with either two-thirds of Congress or a national constitutional convention proposing one, and then three-fourths of the states have to ratify it.
As different as the nation's 27 ratified amendments all are, some guaranteeing basic liberties and justice, one outlawing alcohol, then one allowing it once more, they all have one thing in common. They were proposed to the people by a two-thirds vote in Congress. But after an underreported vote this week in Wisconsin's State House, we are actually one step closer to changing that. After hours of debate, the Wisconsin State Senate voted to make the state the 28th out of 34 required to call for a national convention. Let's turn to RT's David Miller for some answers on why Wisconsin legislators felt compelled to do this.
Is the national debt the biggest threat to national security? With all the recent terror attacks and calls for reform to gun control, the mainstream media is not reporting the major concern for many states, and now add Wisconsin to that list. Lawmakers there have made Wisconsin the 28th state to request an unprecedented national convention to amend the country's founding document, the U.S. Constitution. Ronald Reagan said, quote, "It is clear that we must rely on the states to force Congress to act on our balanced budget amendment. Fortunately, our nation's founders gave us the means to amend the Constitution through action of state legislatures." According to the Balanced Budget Amendment Task Force in 2017, the gross national debt for our nation was 107% of the GDP. And during the height of World War II, the national debt reached 122% of the GDP. And after the war, because of the reduction of government spending and a growing economy, the national debt did drop to 36% of the GDP in 1980. On the BB4USA website, for the last 60 years, the world's richest nation borrowed money to fund the cost of its national government as the national debt has increased each year since 1956. William H. Fruth, the president of Polycom Corporation, an economic research firm, claims that Congress over the last 30 years spent more each year than it has received in revenue. Borrowed money from foreign entities, which have given them significant influence over foreign and trade policies, looted all of the federal trust and pension funds to pay for its deficits, also instructing the Federal Reserve Bank to print money to pay for our government. On June 11th of 2009, The Economist magazine warned the world of the mounting U.S. debt. On that day, it stood at $11.5 trillion. Today, it is $7.7 trillion more. And according to BB4USA.org, since 2000, the gross national debt has increased $14 trillion, and Congress will borrow at least another $9 trillion from 2017 to 2025. In order to change the Constitution process for ratification, the Constitution would have to be amended. The convention does not have the power to amend a Constitution, only to propose an amendment that states across the country are now calling for. And now with a president and a Congress that cannot agree on anything from health care to gun reform control, many are questioning whether they can agree to a balanced budget, and a balanced budget that many are calling a threat to national security. In Washington, D.C., David Miller, RT America.
Ooh, man, I understand why people look at the U.S., you know, the national debt and say this is a threat to national security. There's no reason we should be running this high off debt, but we have, you know, wonderful generations now of politicians have kind of kicked the can down the road.
Well, somebody had, it's not, you know, you can't fight terrorism, you know, without money.
Without putting it on the old debit card.
I know. Oh, but I'm a jerk for having student loans. Yeah, okay. Yeah. My credit's terrible because I tried to get an education. The U.S. goes to war, and we're like, well, that's okay.
You know, cha-ching.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Tab, I don't know if it's really that realistic or good of an idea to then say, oh, we're going to have a constitutional convention and, you know, change the, add an amendment to the Constitution.
What are you going to do about it when there's no money? Oh, it's unconstitutional that you don't have a, that you haven't balanced the deficit. What if there's no money? What if something's happening? Are you just going to run this like it's unconstitutional? It just doesn't seem a place for it. And a lot of opponents have the feeling that they make a really interesting point, is that if they have control of the White House, and like you said, the Congress, Senate, House, the whole thing, why do you need a congressional, why do you need a constitutional amendment just to do your job? Congress should just do its job and balance the budget.
Yeah.
That is their job.
Good
they
point.
Shouldn't need it to be a constitutional issue just to do it.
And let's also remember that, let's say, look, they only need about, what, so they're at 28, so about six more potential states, then they can bring it, and then you got to get the two-thirds.
They can ask to have one.
Yeah. Now, let's say all that happens, right? And they say, yes, we will have one.
Let's also remember that then every single amendment in the Constitution basically becomes wide open for change.
Oh, yeah, it isn't just, oh, we're just going to have this convention and talk about the one thing. No, 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 it's going to open the door, which means every far right and far left, you know,
crackpot idea
is going to come out in the open and be like, nope, I want my 6 hours
Plus,
to talk about.
Do you really trust Chuck Schumer and Ted Cruz with being able to, like, rewrite the Constitution at will, essentially? Do we really want this cast of characters?
It would be written by lobbyists. Let's be real.
Right. And you know, I want to just throw in one quick thing just to finish off, too. They don't respect the constitutional amendments as they are. They don't respect the First Amendment or the Second Amendment or the Fourth or Fifth Amendment as it is. So why would they respect an amendment saying, hey, balance the budget? All right. As we go to break, Hawk Watchers, don't forget to let us know what you think of the topics we've covered on Facebook and Twitter. See our full shows at RT.com. Coming up, Tabitha Wallace gives us her report on one of the most controversial new books of the year as she breaks down Donna Brazile's new tome. And then we bring you the second part of Sean Stone's new interview with Jenny Mai on her new documentary on human trafficking. Stay tuned to Watching the Hawks.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
In the last 12 months, we've been inundated with books about the 2016 presidential election, from Hillary Clinton herself to Alec Baldwin. It seems everyone has something to say, and while this is normal and hardly something to consider a reason for criticism, we are once again, as we did with Hillary just months ago, seeing a woman told that she should have just gotten in line and shut her mouth. That woman is Donna Brazile, the first African-American in the U.S. to direct a major presidential campaign. In her long political career, she was on the staff of 7 presidential campaigns, was a strategist for 56 House and Senate seats, and by the year 2000 had helped elect Democrats in 49 states. But it was her job as interim chair of the DNC following Debbie Wasserman Schultz's exit in the wake of the alleged Russian spying and possible theft of emails later published by WikiLeaks that truly makes her story worth hearing. In Hacks, her new book, Donna Brazile describes an incredibly toxic environment where she, a 30-year political veteran, faced sexism one would not expect from a Hillary supporter, much less her team. According to Hacks, Robbie Mook's team was almost exclusively young, inexperienced males who were obsessed with data and power above all else. Brazile had numerous run-ins with Mook's team, who were often blatantly disrespectful of ideas she brought to the table. On Monday morning of this week, Robbie Mook told CNN, quote, "We certainly don't recognize the campaign she describes. We also don't recall some of the events she said happened," which is interesting because Mook also admitted in that interview that at that point he had not even read the book, which came out on Tuesday, meaning by his own admission, he has no factual basis to even make that judgment call, but he chose to. Also in Hacks, Brazile describes her discovering upon begrudgingly taking the job as interim chair of the DNC that the party was not only financially broke, but that all power necessary for the DNC to ensure fair and democratic elections took place was now in the hands of the Hillary Clinton campaign, and had been for quite some time. Brazile discovered that a standard joint fundraising agreement made with the Clinton campaign was not so standard after all. In a memo describing it, Robbie Mook states that the campaign will take over all financial responsibilities of the DNC, would pay off their debts, and make money available as needed to the DNC. It also revealed a barely legal money laundering scheme that allowed the campaign to use the DNC as a cover for FEC rules on donation caps. Brazile describes a powerful ego in the hearts of the campaign, which ultimately worked as a detriment to the Hillary campaign and its fundraising. See, in mid-August of 2016, just days after taking the job, Brazile writes about how the Trump campaign was erroneously claiming that a majority of the people protesting his campaign were paid protesters. Sadly, he was right in the case of the duck. It turns out that the Hillary campaign, with the permission of Hillary herself, went out and hired actors in Donald Duck costumes to protest Trump ducking the release of his taxes. But Brazile didn't care what Trump thought. It turned out that Disney was upset and asked her to make them stop. Hillary's camp, however, chose to blame the DNC for the stunt. Hacks also details the discovery of financial and ethical problems within the DNC. during Debbie Wasserman Schultz's tenure, from consultants getting paid for nothing to the fact that the board of the DNC was never informed of things like loans taken out, which could be why Donna Brazile might be taking this so seriously and speaking so honestly. The board members of the DNC are personally liable for not only the personal information of donors that was leaked, but for any legal action taken against the DNC. As well, CrowdStrike, interestingly enough, we find out in hacks, wiped every single file on all DNC office computers in the DC office the weekend after the convention. However, despite the Russians coming being Hillary's battle cry, her team refused to give the DNC any money to deal with cybersecurity. Look, many will try and focus on the conspiracy theory that this book is about throwing people under the bus or to save Donna Brazile's career. The truth of hacks is that it's the story of a true believer, someone who had given her entire life up to carry water for a party she believed in, but was dragged into a sexist and toxic work environment where she was expected to be the, well, token black woman who silently supported Hillary at the expense of the party's future. Today, the loyalists are working hard to discredit and discourage Brazile from telling her side of things. They're pointing fingers at the one person in the whole party who seems to have taken the time to do a fearless moral inventory of themselves and their party. Donna Brazile doesn't think she's perfect. She thought she was the last person who should take the job, but she did it, for free no less, and nearly allowed the 2016 election to destroy her entire life. And hacks might be the most uncomfortable and necessary read of the 2016 election.
Oof, oof, oof. And speaking. And speaking of the DNC hacks and former hacks, former NSA whistleblower Bill Binney sat down with our own Ed Schultz, Tabitha, to discuss the recent findings that the DNC hacks may have not really actually been hacks at all, but potentially a direct computer to thumb drive download. Let's take a listen.
Our evidence is it came down locally.
Okay.
So that's the evidence. I mean, it's not a question of saying who did it locally. We don't know. But there are people who are saying certain things that the FBI knows who did it already, and they're not telling the president. And that NSA and FBI together know a lot more than they're telling the president.
Be sure to check out the rest of that interview on RT's The News with Ed Schultz. Awesome, awesome interview. But wow, Tab, so you sat up. You got the book. You sat up 5 hours, buried into it.
5 hours. It was more than 5 hours. It was till 5 o'clock.
Till 5 a.m., buried into the book. Clearly a good book.
Yeah, it's necessary. I think if you're going to read, I mean, I read Hillary's book. Mm-hmm. A good portion of it I actually heard in her own words because I thought that was really important. And then when this book came available, I really did want to see that other perspective of someone who wasn't. I mean, Donna Brazile is not some, you know, political powerhouse that was running around. She was somebody you called who got the job done, who yeah. knew everyone in the state level, who knew how to get things done for a campaign.
And it's interesting when you were speaking earlier too about the now controversial memo about the kind of control of the DNC party that you were talking
yeah.
about,
and
Mook
this is
getting
the,
his hands in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and I'm
that.
Like, I don't know how to kind of take it, but when you read it, it's very odd. It's clearly somebody who doesn't understand how government works, how these things work, and party, not just politics, but just basic decorum and how things work. Because when you look at this, in that memo that Robbie Mook sent out to people in the DNC, what he said is, if you look at it, it states, if asked by a state party, the DNC will encourage this state party to become a participant in the Victory Fund. Now, remember, the Victory Fund is what they were sort of washing money through. Mm. All of that money, almost all of it, would end up going straight back to the Hillary Clinton campaign in Brooklyn. And also, in what it seems to be an odd way to run a political party, the whole agreement, which was hidden from DNC board members, by the way, we find out in the book, says, if this memorandum correctly summarizes your agreement, please reply by email with the text, agreed by DNC.
Wow.
You don't agree
wow.
to financial. This is one of those things is I don't think Robbie Mook knew the rules of the DNC, the bylaws of the DNC. I don't think he really. It seems to me from reading the book that nobody cared. That the DNC was ancillary to this campaign and it didn't matter.
Wow.
All that mattered was getting Hillary elected.
Wow. Wow. It's also interesting because, you know, as you were telling me that she made
you know, everybody was making moves to kind of like push the Russia thing on her,
right,
from like Eric Holder, Susan Rice, you know, and
well, not even just the Russia thing. It seems that it's, they were saying that the DNC, they were confused by the fact that the DNC and W. Westerman Schultz just didn't seem to care about it.
Wow.
While they were talking about it in the news of the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. They're saying, you know, you had at a number of things. Actually, at Obama's 55th birthday, she tells the story that in one moment, while she's just the port girls, just trying to get to the dance floor before Beyonce hits the stage. Mm. And Eric Holder and Susan Rice came up to her and said, the DNC is not getting back to us. We need to take
stuff.
It seriously.
Fascinating stuff, definitely. Yeah. Thank you for giving us that dynamic book report, Tabitha.
Thanks.
The human trafficking crisis is unique in that it sits at the crossroads of so many different issues, clearly a matter of basic human rights, but also one of law and criminal justice. It has its roots in both historic cultural background as well as the modern global economy. Some have set out to tackle the problem no matter how complex it may really be, including TV personality and activist Jeannie Mai, executive producer of the documentary Stopping Traffic. Sean Stone recently sat down with Jeannie to learn more about the economic engine driving human trafficking.
So it starts there, right? Cheap labor is a quick way for every person, whether it's to fix your house, to mow your lawn, and now moving over to taking care of your children. Nannies are trafficked here and are the easiest, quickest way for us to take care of our children so that we can go and work our jobs. Then it goes on a greater level to companies. You know, a lot of companies are selling clothing for such a cheap amount of money, and you wonder, how are you buying this t-shirt for $8? Not realizing that somewhere in a factory in India that children are working to make that clothing for you, and you're buying it and you're supporting that supply chain of slavery. You know, so when it comes to the global economy, we need to make money, we are broke, and cheap labor is available out there, and then those people are getting trafficked to fill that need, and so that cycle is happening. Of course, the next question is, why is it happening? Why aren't we not stopping it? Well, like I mentioned, trafficking has only become apparent to us in the last 10 years. The word modern day slavery, we only know slavery as of, you know, back in, you know, African Americans being enslaved and being brought here. Now to understand that it's a much greater problem, people are just learning this. I can easily walk down the street and ask if anybody knows about human trafficking and find that more than 50% of those people won't know what I'm talking about. And they'll either be holding a cup of coffee that has come from some type of enslaved victims that are, you know, working to get those coffee beans to us, to wearing a t-shirt from a store that might have come from an enslaved factory. So it just comes down to, again, films like mine or this conversation that's taking place for us to understand and break down where trafficking takes place. You know, it's a lot. It's a bigger problem that takes a lot of time for us to break out the knowledge and then touch into our government officials to then make the changes that we need to put legislative law into action.
You know, there's an assumption of male predation when it comes to human trafficking and the traffickers involved. But what is the female role in the traffic?
I know a lot of times we blame the males, and they are a big part of it, are the males that are involved. But women happen to also be involved because women play a different role that men can't do. For example, when I talked about the brothels that I lived in, all brothels are headed by a mama-san. You know, there are 17 different brothels here on Sunset Boulevard, by the way, so don't get it twisted that it's only overseas. There are brothels, strip clubs, prostitution houses, trap houses that are led by women because women they are able to hold a different type of conversation with women to lure them in. Women trust other women. There's a sisterhood, so immediately you trust a mama-san to be able to be your caretaker, a nurturer, and then there's a manipulation that takes place that only women can do that are different from men. Also, kids listen to women differently. So when a woman takes on a child, whether the child has been bought, sold, or returned, the child will just innately trust a woman differently because we want that mother figure. So women are either hosted by the traffic agents that are usually men and can't break out of it. They're being trafficked themselves to do their job of what they know well, to house these homes or these children, and the cycle just continues.
And that is our show for you today. Remember, everyone, in this world, we are not told we are loved enough, so I tell you all, I love you. I am Tyrell Ventura.
And I'm Tabitha Wallace.
Keep on watching those hawks, and have a great day and night, everybody.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.